is Suzanne Duplantis, and welcome to my first Lyric Fest podcast. The good news is I'm here with one of my favorite people, guitarist Alan Krantz. Alan is joining us for our next concert, Humming and Strumming. The concerts are April 3rd at the Community House in Morristown, New Jersey at 6 p.m. and on April 4th at the Ethical Society on Rittenhouse Square at 5:30 p.m. Unusual performance times. The goal is to help you get a little music into your work week. Both events start with a reception with wine and hors d'oeuvres, followed by a concert of about 45 minutes. We hope you'll treat yourself to some music. To get us started, here are some things you should know about Alan, besides the fact that I think he's an extraordinary guitarist and human being. Alan also plays the mandolin. He's a composer who has had pieces premiered by members of the Philadelphia Orchestra and by the orchestra itself, and he's given pre-concert talks for the orchestra. He's a sought-after chamber musician and a sought-after teacher. And lastly, he signs his name with a small letter A, and he doesn't use a cell phone. Crazy. So, Alan, can you give us a little background about music for the guitar and voice? How long has this been going on?
I think it's been going on forever, really. I think it goes on before we have written music, because the first lute music that's written down is from around 1490. But we know that the troubadours and trouvères, you know, use the lute. So I think the lute is, you know, sort of like the lyre. It's like a continuation of the accompaniment of poetry. Mm. So therefore, I think you could say it's, you know, it's almost timeless, the idea of spoken or sung words to the accompaniment of an instrument like the guitar or the lute or the lyre or the harp, all those things.
And usually was the singer and player one and the same?
That's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about the early things. You know, the most notable singer and player was John Dowland, and we're going to be doing some Dowland. Right. But it seems that partly what was notable about him was that it must have been a little bit unusual. Mm-hmm. And you know, as lute accompaniments got more and more intricate, I think generally that was a separate person from the singer.
Do we know how he was educated?
Dowland?
Yeah.
I think the big thing we know is that he was Catholic at a difficult time to be Catholic, and he probably grew, I think, through the Catholic music system.
Right, because I'm thinking we have transcriptions of his...
Oh, yeah. I mean, his music's in lute tablature, and he was widely published in his time.
Right.
So his music is pretty well accounted for, and I think almost everything we have was actually published in his lifetime. And the interesting thing about Dowland, from a vocal point of view, is that his songs took a number of forms. Yeah, so he got a lot of mileage out of his songs.
Okay, so I wondered whether we should perform a little bit of that.
So what are you thinking to do?
I will do a little bit of Can She Excuse Me?
Okay.
Moms. What do you think?
That's fine. I need to get the capo.
Okay.
You know, it really is amazing how much you can talk about voice and guitar, though. I mean, you know, like,
Dowland is, like, considered almost the first leader writer, you know, because his accompaniments in his more elaborate songs prefigure Schubert's piano accompaniments.
So tell us what you're doing to retune there.
I'm tuning my third string down a half step. So the lute was tuned very much like the guitar in intervals of a fourth, except for one third, and in the lute the third's right in the middle, which I always think has some sort of religious significance of the Trinity being central. And the guitar has the third between the second and third strings as opposed to the third and the fourth. Then I'm using a capo, like folk singers use, to raise the pitch of the guitar, and I'm raising it a whole step, even though technically the lute was a minor third higher, that is three half steps. I'm doing two half steps, a whole step, because their pitch was lower. So I think this gets you to pretty close to what the original is.
Shall I call the good when she the streets? What was happening with the regular people?
Well, I think the history of the lute and the guitar, they're portable, relatively inexpensive. You know, God knows in the Renaissance, the organ was the king of instruments, but the lute was the queen. And I think, you know, it was used for all kinds of music. I mean, God knows the lute literature has everything from low to high. It has lots mm-hmm. and lots of popular songs. It has mm-hmm. many, many dances. And it has a lot of what we call intabulations, where lute composers would take vocal music, for instance, the motets, sacred motets of the Flemish school of Josquin and Ockeghem and people like that, and they would literally intabulate them, put them on the lute, and a lot of the solo lute literature, in other words, was reductions of famous and sacred vocal music.
Where's the link between lute and guitar? Were they both at the same time, or did they,
That's a really good question. The lute was clearly the preeminent instrument of the Renaissance and right through the Baroque era. There was a Renaissance guitar. It was a little four-string guitar that there's some music for, certainly nice music, but it's not the main instrument. Mm-hmm. Also, we have to remember that in the Renaissance, the vihuela in Spain was their version of the lute. It looked like a guitar, but it was really strung, double strung, and same tuning as the lute. Mm-hmm. So the Spaniards always preferred a guitar-like shape, but that instrument's more of a lute than a guitar. Mm-hmm. There's a Baroque guitar in the court of Louis XIV. He had a court guitarist named Robert de Vizet. Mm-hmm. So the guitar was there, but the modern guitar that we know really didn't come about until after the lute died away. So the mm-hmm. lute kind of expires in Germany. That's the last gasp of the lute. And that's when you see the guitar now comes into its own, the modern six-string guitar. So all those other things that were called guitars, they're pretty different than a modern guitar. I mean, there were citerns in England. There were all kinds of plucked. I mean, the history of this stuff is so convoluted.
It's so interesting, you know, because today we think, you know, there's classical guitar and then there's the guitar of the people. And
right.
I just wondered if that same thing was happening.
Well, in a way, I guess you could say that's true, which is that, I mean, you would say that the lute was the classical instrument mm-hmm. until the beginning of the 19th century. But there were all these other guitars and citerns mm-hmm. and bandoras and a million other instruments. Just like now, if you did a history of all the different kinds of guitars, the electric guitars yeah. and the many variations of that, the jazz, you know, it's really a bit overwhelming mm-hmm. because these are popular instruments and they're, you know, they're accessible and widely disseminated. The interesting thing is that when the guitar came in at the beginning of the 18th century, it was mainly used to accompany songs. And mm-hmm. the first virtuoso guitar composers who were beginning to imitate piano music and write sonatas, they were criticized. What are you doing making this little guitar, you know, try to do a Beethoven sonata? Right, you should be accompanying songs. Be happy with your place.
So does that have to do with, you know, how it became a house music instrument?
Yeah, I think, again, it was inexpensive, portable. Mm-hmm. First of all, people love to play songs and to accompany songs with a guitar. But then there was this, you know, generation of virtuoso guitarists who wanted it to do more than just that, even though they themselves wrote songs, and that was always a big part of the literature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know you know, but the people listening to this might not realize that so many Schubert songs were published originally with alternate guitar accompaniments because there was a market for it. Mm-hmm. And I have discovered that there's this whole literature of guitar and piano music. So mm-hmm. they were accompanying mm-hmm. songs one or the other, but mm-hmm. they were both house instruments and they played together too. Mm.
So was there a point that it made the leap from house instrument to concert stage, or did that just kind of gradually?
Well, I think, you know, I think that both things were happening, just mm-hmm. like the piano. I mean, mm-hmm. people were playing the piano in their homes, but, you know, Franz Liszt was turning it into a concert instrument at the same time. And so I think the guitar has a kind of a similar, you know, history where it's, I mean, there's a great market, and the virtuoso composers are writing virtuoso music, but they're also writing more accessible music that people can play. So it's not one or the other. Mm-hmm.
So I wondered if you could tell us about the instrument itself.
My instrument, or
yeah,
or just
either,
what a guitar
either,
is like.
Yeah, could tell us about the strings and the shape and the sound and what makes a classical instrument.
Well, the shape of, is it's, you know, what it's been since the Vihuela and all these other instances, which is, you know, a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a, you know, Segovia always talked that way. He says, well, the guitar is like this shapely woman, you
yeah.
know, you have to caress it and, you,
yeah.
you know, that's old, you know, old school
uh-huh.
Latin,
yeah.
Latin lover
uh-huh.
Way of looking at the guitar. But to me, the thing that's amazing about the guitar is how simple it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the classical guitar, you don't play with a pick. You play with your fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
Modern players in the old days, they played probably more with their flesh than
mm-hmm.
with nails.
Mm-hmm.
But we use nails because it helps us project
mm-hmm.
and also get more colors. But I think the remarkable thing is that it's a six-string instrument, pretty simple, and yet we play keyboard-like music on it. You know,
mm-hmm.
we play Bach fugues. We
mm-hmm.
play... you know, very elaborate things. And when I'm, you know,
mm-hmm.
doing songs, sometimes I'm just, you know, transcribing the piano accompaniment to the guitar. And it's, I'm amazed. I compose for the guitar. I'm amazed at what a guitar can do. You know, it has to be in the right key. It's very hard to compose well for it if you don't play it, because it's got secrets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's got hidden resonances and secrets. It still, after all this time, is kind of a mysterious thing to
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm. So I was going to talk about, or ask you to talk about Spain and Spain's special relationship to the guitar.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting, I don't know what, the simple answer is that the Moorish invasion
mm-hmm.
brought instruments like the guitar, and certainly the lute, the oud, which is
mm-hmm.
the same instrument as the lute,
mm-hmm.
they brought these instruments into Spain. I mean, it's interesting, the history of the guitar is kind of bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the wrong word, but it's a double history. So you have the kitara and the lyre and things like that coming from Greece and coming from the northern part of the Mediterranean
mm-hmm.
into the rest of Europe. And then you have, from the Middle East, you have Northern Africa and the Moorish penetration into Spain. And, you know, one of the things that's amazing about Spanish music, it's really like the first, you know, world music, or one of the first world musics, you know, because you have Jews and Arabs and Christians all living together until the Inquisition, and the music really reflects it. I mean, and what we think of as Spanish music, I'm in the wrong tuning to play for you, but...
I'll take that off.
All right, so... I mean, that classic sound is, I'm just taking a very simple chord and dragging it. So those kind of very dissonant, tangy, spicy sounds.
That's all Moorish?
Well,
is
that yes, the Spanish music. Right? I mean, that's pretty much a combination of Moorish, you know, plus the guitar fits that, you see. And if you listen to the, you know, the great Spanish classical music of Albéniz and Granados, they're evoking that music in their harmonies for the piano, and they use those kind of dissonances, you know, that in a lot of ways grow out of string instruments like the guitar.
So I thought maybe we would do the first of the Mano de Falla.
So these are pretty challenging on the guitar, and many of them clearly have the guitar in mind.
Right.
But when composers like Scarlatti, you know, who lived in Spain, and when his harpsichord music imitates the guitar, or when Albéniz imitates, it's a bionic guitar. In other words, it's like an idealized, larger-than-life guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So to actually play them on the guitar, sometimes it works, you know, fairly easy. Lots of times,
it's not
like,
gonna work.
Well, it can work, but, you know, it's not like, it doesn't just automatically get done, because of larger scale and all that. All right, so we can try.
Let's give it a try.
Okay.
I'm not.
is even within this cycle.
Well,
right?
The guitar's always going out of tune, so we have to add that to the equation.
Okay.
But first of all, we tune our bass string down a lot of times to fit certain keys. Because the guitar thrives, one of the reasons it's able to play piano-like music is to get it in the right key where there's open strings in the bass that add to the resonance, and also mean you don't have to finger every single bass note. Then retuning bass notes to give us at least some open strings.
Okay. So it's tuned low string to high. So the one closest to your...
Yes, I'm always trying to get people... I'm teaching a course of guitar for non-music majors, and they really want to call the string that's farthest from the ground.
Yes.
They want to call that the high,
string.
And I said, but listen to it. It's lower. This is not, we're talking about audio things here, right? So from it's not geography.
Right. I love it. Okay, so you're brave. You like to make a lot of arrangements of late classical music.
But when I first started playing the guitar, I had repertoire envy. A very bad case of repertoire envy. There were no Mozart string quartets. There were no Beethoven string quartets, Schubert piano sonata. I became an inveterate transcriber of everything I could get my hands on. I spent, you know, almost a year trying to make a Brahms intermezzo work for the guitar. Where some of it worked, and then some of it just, I finally had to concede and, you know, give up. But I really feel like all the transcribing I did is what taught me to be a composer, because it made me get inside all this music and really figure out what made it tick and what was essential and what I could, when you transcribe, certainly for the piano, if you take piano music, you have to reduce it to play it on the guitar. If you take, let's say, Bach solo cello music, you have to slightly expand it, but you really have to know what you're doing.
You settled on the folk songs, I guess you thought.
Well,
that was
you know, when it comes to Brahms, whose style is notoriously thick, unlike Schubert's, you know? Right. I mean, Schubert is, and Mozart are kind of consommés. Brahms is a pretty creamy soup, right? You know? You know, it's just most Brahms, to really do it justice, it's too thick. And it's and the guitars, you know, the guitar is a really good vehicle for early romantic music. Less so for late romantic, but I adore Brahms and realized that his folk songs, which really sound like Brahms, but because he was trying to stay out of the way of the original folk song, he was very discreet with them, and those lend themselves to the guitar.
Right. So you've set a couple, and we're going to do at least one of them on this program.
Yes.
So why don't we get that out?
Okay.
And that is Da unten im Tale.
And see, a lot of my tuning is just because I tune slightly differently for different keys. You want to make sure, because the guitar has frets, so where a violin, which does not have frets, can make subtle adjustments, you know, you're stuck, right? So it's a complicated thing what really sounds in tune on the guitar. Thank you.
you and I both probably fell in love with that song, both Liamo.
Yeah.
So what do you do about American songbook repertoire? We're going to do A Ship Without a Sail, and I just handed you a piano part with chord symbols.
Yeah,
what do you
well,
do when you when somebody like me does that to you?
Try to have fun. I mean, it's, you know, so again, that just shows, like so much popular music, it's published in a form for piano, but above it is symbols for guitar chord. So, that you know, it says something right there about the sort of interchangeability of guitar and piano. It really depends on the
just
song.
Just as in Schubert's time.
So yeah, exactly. That's right. That's right. They're the two great accompaniment instruments for the voice, right? And and it depends on the song, depends on the key, you know, what you do with it. But you can be simple or more complicated.
Yeah. So we've barely put this together, but do you want to give it a try?
Okay. I think it's in this pile. And yeah, I don't even know this song. So.
Yeah.
We could do...
to know how we rehearse.
Yeah, okay. here it is. And of course, I'll probably make my own version of this once I get familiar with it. It's got a million page turns, so I won't be able to do it. Okay, so how does this go again?
Well, the first part is the verse, and it doesn't get into the tune.
And I think we said something about me doing, that I would begin with a, what's the tempo though?
I don't know what day it is, or if it's that's very free.
Okay.
I think you just have to play a chord or something.
And then. Idea of what the song is about, and then we'll go from there. But
yeah,
But we're both pretty good at, I mean, we have pages falling on
that's,
the floor.
I know, and I'm saying wrong words.
Yeah, it, so.
But yeah, it's fun to do this stuff.
Absolutely, and it's good for us. It loosens us up.
Yes. So, any parting words on the guitar? Anything you're desperately trying to have
people
know?
I'd just like to say one thing, which is, you know, I've spent my life playing more chamber music than the average guitarist. I just was oriented toward that right from the beginning, I think. And if somebody asked me what is the greatest body of chamber music for the guitar, ultimately, I mean, I say it behind your back. I don't just say it to you. It's vocal music. Composers like Dowlin, composers like Benjamin Britten, you know, Michael Tippett, you know, I mean, the fact that we get to play Schubert, you know, Mozart. So I think it's a, you know, just a fantastic body of music, and I really try to encourage my students, you know, and there's nothing, I mean, the voice ultimately, I mean, what do musicians do? They imitate singers. Mm-hmm. You know, that means if you play your instrument well, you make it sing. Mm-hmm. And so, and the voice has, you know, with a good singer, more nuance, more color, more inflection, more, you know, all the things that we should be listening for, A, to accompany, but also to try to adopt in our own playing.
Right. So we are going to end this podcast, and it has been a lot of fun. We're hoping that it has all been recorded.
Right.
Since it's my first time, this technology thing is not my forte.
Well, we covered a lot of ground there.
We did. So we hope that you will join us on either April 3rd or April 4th, or both. You can learn more or order tickets at www.lyricfest.org. Alan Krantz, thank you so much.